introductory matters. We have with us on the court today Rick Schroeder, who is, Rick Schreiner. Got names confused here. Rick Schreiner, who is joining us from the District Court from Beatrice today. Justice Nora Lerman is recused from the last two cases of the day. With that, we will move forward. The first case of the day is Jordan versus LSFH Master Participation Trust. Mr. Schroeder, good morning to you.
Thank you, Judge Pendleton. May it please the court, I'm Ken Schroeder of Picardy, and I represent the appellant here today, Richard Jordan. I'm sure you're aware that this is a case involving the Homestead Act and whether the deed of trust executed in favor of AmeriQuest, subsequently acquired by LSFH, is a valid and enforceable deed of trust. There are two significant cases with respect to homesteads and deeds of trust. The Neal Production Credit Association, a 1981 case, and Mutual Omaha Bank, a 2017 case. In the O'Neill case, this court found that, and I quote, an interest in the homestead will simply not pass nor be created unless the documents for that purpose are signed and acknowledged by both the husband and the wife. More importantly, that opinion also found that the statutory requirements of the Homestead Act cannot be supplied by estoppel. And there were no qualifiers in that case, nor any noted exception to that rule. Estoppel cannot come forward to supply the needed necessary execution and acknowledgments with respect to complying with the Nebraska's Homestead Act. In the Mutual Omaha case, the court said in a long line of cases, this court has held that an acknowledgement is essential in conveying a homestead. Similarly, in cases extending back to the 1800s, this court has held that an instrument purporting to convey or encumber the homestead of a married person is void if it is not executed and acknowledged by both the husband and the wife. It's our position that once LSFH became apprised of the fact that Kelly Jordan did not appear in the state of Iowa in the county of Pottawatomie to sign and execute and acknowledge her signature on the deed of trust to AmeriQuest, when in fact the loan closing occurred in Kearney, Nebraska, and she admits that she's never been in her entire life in the state of Iowa, that the deed of trust acquired by LSFA is frankly simply void by operational law and unenforceable.
How did the district court decide this case?
Pardon?
How did the district court decide this case?
The district court went through collateral estoppel. I guess we now refer to that as claim and issue preclusion, judicial estoppel, equitable estoppel, ratification, and something else, and said we ratified all of this in the Merrill Dissolution Action.
Why is that not correct?
Why is that not correct? Well, first of all, LSFA was not a party to that. And in spite of the fact that Judge Wright, in all due respect, found that we could have litigated the validity of the deed of trust in the dissolution action, I find to be almost, I don't understand that. I don't know how we could have litigated the validity of the deed of trust in the marital dissolution case when LSFA is not a party to that, nor could we have made LSFA a party to that. Judge Wright doesn't explain, nor does anybody else explain, nor does LSFA explain how they could become a party to a marital dissolution action to determine the validity of a deed of trust.
Does issue preclusion require LSFA to have been a party to the dissolution action?
Absolutely. I don't know how. I mean, how could you adjudicate the rights of somebody that's not there? It's beyond me.
Claim preclusion would require that, but does issue preclusion require it?
Pardon?
Claim preclusion would require the parties be identical, but does issue preclusion have that same requirement?
Yes. I don't think the claim preclusion does not, in this case, preclude Richard Jordan from raising that issue.
So your position is that the decree of dissolution, that judgment, that decree doesn't really have any impact in our analysis here?
It does not. And it should not. It's our position that the requirements of the Homestead Act are involuntary. You cannot comply with something that you didn't comply with. Richard Jordan raised the fact that, let me do a timeline here. In March of 2011, a dissolution complaint was filed. We have it there. On September 18th, we have the first day of trial. Kelly Jordan then files bankruptcy, so we're stops. And the stay goes into effect. Then, in August 26th of 2013, a year later, we finish the second day of trial. On November 15th of 2013, the decree of dissolution is there. Keep in mind that during this entire period of time, Richard Jordan was excluded from the Merrill home. So it's Kelly Jordan who's making the payments. Richard Jordan did not know at that point in time that his name had been forged on the deed of trust. He didn't know that his name had been forged on the quitclaim deed. And to be honest with you, we were confused as to why Kelly Jordan would acquire a quitclaim deed from her husband. To this day, I still don't understand why they did that. So, Richard Jordan is awarded the house, the homestead. He moves into it and gets a letter of default. And that's when we started looking into the fact that the deed of trust had also been, his name had also been forged on that document. And so then we filed the claim in August of 2015 to set aside the deed of trust.
So is it your position that you did not have, or your client did not have the opportunity to contest those issues in the divorce?
Well, certainly you had the opportunity. I mean, the registered deeds office is open to anybody, everybody, 5 days a week. But you had no reason to go over and check that. I mean, this guy's an old road trucker. His wife is running the household. She's making the mortgage payments. He had no reason, after he was excluded from the house for almost 2 years, living elsewhere, he had no reason to go to the courthouse to see if, in fact, there was a deed of trust that was different than the Green Tree financing. That was the original financing. When his deposition was taken and questions were asked about, you know, did you acknowledge that and sign that installment? Sure he did. The installment contract that he was talking about was the installment contract back in 1995 when they secured financing from Green Tree.
Can you tell me, with the record, what was his position in the divorce with respect to his signature, if any? The authenticity of his signature.
With respect to the deed of trust or the deed?
Let's do all of them. Yeah. What, in the divorce, was it explicit?
He raised the validity of his signature with respect to the quitclaim deed during the dissolution. He did not raise the validity of his signature on the deed of trust until after the decree of dissolution, which is when he then took possession of the house, moved back into the family residence, and got a notice of default, because what happened was the minute his wife moved out, or the minute that he was awarded the house, she moved out and quit making the payments. And so that's when the default notice occurred. The last one I went over to the courthouse, got the deed of trust to see exactly what it was.
So to summarize, your position is not that the husband and wife were not parties and were not bound by the dissolution decree. Your position is that the issue of non-signature of the deed of trust, or fraudulent signature of the deed of trust, simply was not raised in the divorce.
It was not raised in the divorce. You know what? Interestingly enough, the rules of the district court in the Ninth Judicial District, and the rules are similar in other districts too, is that the plaintiff has an obligation to file the first property statement. In this particular instance, Mr. Jordan did not file the first property statement. Kelly Jordan filed the first property statement. She also filed a counterclaim. Eventually, Richard dismissed his complaint, and the case was tried on the counterclaim. So when the first property statement got filed, she identified the mortgage as MSBS, or MCBS, as I recall. And Richard looks at that. That doesn't say Americ West. It doesn't say LSF8.
Doesn't say Green Tree, though, either, does it?
It doesn't say Green Tree, either.
Somewhere along the line, there's some evidence that he's aware there's a change. Is that right?
I guess you could assume that, but then on the other hand, many of these mortgages are handled by third-party administrators that administer the underlying deed of trust, and so you really don't know.
If the papers are being sold, the papers reflecting debt, would that raise a question in the mind of a litigant, or would a litigant just assume that's how commerce is done?
Well, there certainly is no evidence that the transfer of the paper from one person or from one entity to the next entity is noticed to the signatories on the original contract. I'm not aware that when a debt or a mortgage debt is assigned from one party to the next party, they have to give notice to the original originator. That there's no way they would know unless they walked down to the Register of Deeds office.
But the document may have that in it that it can be assigned without notice.
As far as I know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Stolnacher, good morning to you.
May it please the Court, John Stolnacher with Stolnacher Beckham Burrish in Omaha. I represent LSFA Master Participation Trust, the appellee in this case. The counsel started off with a recitation of all the reasons why the deed of trust, that's the base of this case, is either valid or invalid. And the issue with that is that wasn't even discussed or decided by the court below. That is how this case started. It started as a dispute over whether the deed of trust was valid or not based upon the alleged forgery of Mr. George's signature on that document. However, the appellee argued in the lower court, and Judge Wright agreed, that Mr. Jordan was barred from even raising that issue under the doctrines of judicial estoppel, and as was termed then, collateral estoppel, which we now are referring to as claim preclusion. The facts underlying this have all to do with what happened in the dissolution action. Mr. Jordan, in that dissolution action, argued and urged successfully that Judge Wright, who also was a presiding judge in the dissolution action, in the property...
Before you go on to this next step, perhaps I'm not following your argument, but didn't the very last sentence of Judge Wright's decree say the court therefore finds that the deed of trust recorded blah 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 is a valid first and prior lien on the real estate as against all other claims? So
yes.
How can you argue that he didn't decide the issue of the validity of the deed of trust?
Well, I suppose that at the end he did. We have not filed a cross appeal in this matter. I think it may have been more appropriate to issue a finding that as to Mr. Jordan, and perhaps as to Kelly Fairchild, who previously Mrs. Jordan, as to those two parties, perhaps it is valid and not contestable. I do understand that any other interested party was not a party to this specific case.
You anticipated my exact question. As an old real estate lawyer, I'm reading this saying, these people were the only parties. You can't litigate as to the claims of other parties. So on this record today, you are confessing plain error as to the last sentence of that.
Only with respect to it being effective as to all parties not included in this litigation, yes.
Okay. Thank you. That's totally fine.
I think we would have to confess that. To do otherwise, it would be disingenuous.
Thank you very much.
However, we do take the position that as to Mr. Jordan, and although Ms. Fairchild is not here today contesting this, we would argue as to her as well, that the positions that they each individually urged the court to take in the dissolution action, specifically with respect to the division of property, they should be held to that and should not now be permitted to come back and say, well, yes, we understand we argued this to the court when we were having our marriage dissolved, and it worked for both of us, but now we've taken advantage of that argument, and now we're going to come and say, well, exactly the opposite is true, and get the advantage of it again.
So it's judicial estoppel is the basis, you think, of this as opposed to claim preclusion or issue preclusion?
Actually, I believe that both judicial estoppel and claim preclusion would apply.
Claim preclusion or issue preclusion?
I'm sorry?
Is it claim preclusion or issue preclusion?
I believe it's claim preclusion.
Did the district court decide on the basis of issue preclusion?
I'm sorry, I thought it decided on the issue of claim. Well, I think it called it collateral estoppel.
And isn't issue preclusion the term synonymous with collateral estoppel?
My understanding was it was claim preclusion.
Assume that it was the other way around.
Okay.
Claim preclusion is really raised to the judicata.
Okay. In that case, I believe they both apply. And I think there was one question asked.
They both being judicial estoppel
and issue preclusion. Yes, I'm sorry. And I'm sorry for my confusion here in front of this panel. I do believe they both apply, and I think that there is a distinction that was raised between them earlier today where...
You need them both, or do you just need one of them?
We don't need them both. We only need one of them. However, I think the decision is the
best one.
I believe judicial estoppel, or I guess that would be claim preclusion, would be the best one. Because I think it's clear in that case that that both of the parties in this matter, if for example, LSFA did not have to be a party for judicial estoppel or claim preclusion to apply. The basis of that, and I want to distinguish between these theories and the other equitable estoppel theories that were discussed by Mr. Schroeder. Those theories where, and I don't dispute his recitation of the case law, those are the cases. And the case law does say that the requirements of the Olmstead statute cannot be supplied by estoppel. However, all the cases that deal with that issue deal with one party making representations or conduct that a third party relies upon. These theories, claim preclusion and issue preclusion, are a bit different, these statements and positions were relied upon by a court of law. And if we start disregarding positions taken by a party in litigation that were asserted for their benefit, relied upon by a court, or to issue a ruling to the benefit of that party, the loss of that urge, the result, and allowing them to then disregard what they said, we're going to blow a hole.
I beg your pardon, what they said as in what, trial briefs?
Either in trial briefs or submissions.
So what's the significance of saying, taking a position in a trial brief?
Well, and I think this came up in the lower court. And for example, in this case, the position was that that the deed of trust would be an enforceable encumbrance upon the real estate. And we have not argued. Well, we do think that that's a judicial admission. However, more importantly, the issue here is what was the position taken. In other words, it doesn't matter if it was true that the deed of trust was an encumbrance upon the property, and a valid and enforceable encumbrance. What is important with respect to the issues of, claim preclusion and issue preclusion is whether they took the position that it was and whether the court relied upon that position. So in this case, the position was taken by Mr. Jordan and relied upon by the court, at least in part.
How did the court rely on it?
The court relied upon it because, the panel probably is more familiar with than I am, not doing a lot of dissolution work, in the division of property, you're trying to equitably and equally divide assets and liabilities. And in this case, the way that was accomplished by Judge Wright in the dissolution action was to award Mr. Jordan the house subject to the debt
on the house, which was secured by what he deemed a valid and enforceable deed of trust, which is the exact deed of trust we're here talking about today. And without that determination, which was not disputed at any point in time by Mr. Jordan, without that determination, that division of property could not have been done in that way.
Under judicial estoppel, do you also not have to demonstrate that that position was taken in bad faith?
Yes, and I think...
And if so, what is there in the record that would allow us to find the existence of bad faith?
Well, I think that the bad faith is evidenced by the fact that they took the position knowing that there was the possibility that it may not be true. And quite frankly, this litigation, I don't have the exact dates, but it was instigated fairly shortly thereafter. And I want to get back to something that Mr. Schroeder said, which I think somewhat gets to your point. One of the theories, it seemed to me, was that Mr. Jordan knew or thought his signature on a vesting deed was potentially a forgery, but didn't know anything about what this deed of trust was, or maybe if it was valid or not. That position and how this dovetails with bad faith is that I would assert that it's in bad faith to just take a position without trying to investigate whether the position you're taking is accurate.
I'm not sure I followed you. So it may be evidence, is this what you're saying? It may be evidence of bad faith because if one document's squirrely, others might be?
No. What I'm saying is bad faith in litigation would be to assert a position without actually investigating whether it's true or not.
But you're at the summary judgment stage, are you not?
In this particular case, yes, we are.
So that might be a material issue of fact out there.
There may be. However, the standard for review here is whether a finding of fact was clearly erroneous under the judicial estoppel theory. It would be abuse of discretion and whether the finding of fact was clearly erroneous. And I guess the question for this panel would be whether Judge Wright's finding of fact as to those issues were clearly erroneous.
On summary judgment?
I believe so. That's according to the TFF, the Sanitary Improvement District case.
Was that summary judgment?
I believe it was, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have time for rebuttal?
No.
We have no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is State X Rel County.